Hello, I'm Lisa Haynes, Public Relations Specialist for Roland Park Place, where we are redefining metropolitan senior living in Baltimore. You're listening to A Valuable Perspective with stories, advice, and reflections from some of the city's most knowledgeable, well-traveled, and experienced citizens. They are the residents who call Roland Park Place their home. The Baltimore Inner Harbor is often referred to as the heart of Baltimore City, and it is considered to be the city's main attraction for tourists from all over the world, with beautiful office buildings, restaurants, and boutiques overlooking the water. But Baltimore's Inner Harbor was not always this beautiful waterfront. In fact, there are some reports that indicate that before its redevelopment more than 40 years ago, it was abandoned and decaying. But thanks to a team of talented experts, the Inner Harbor was transformed into what is considered to be one of the most amazing places in the U.S. And joining me today for part two of a two-part series is one of the people who made it all possible, Roland Park Place resident, Mr. Martin Millspaugh. He is a lifelong resident of Baltimore who directed the development of the Charles Center and Inner Harbor projects and was an international real estate development consultant. Mr. Millspaugh helped execute the master plan, which dramatically transformed the Charles Center and Baltimore Inner Harbor into amazingly successful places, which then became the model for how to transform waterfronts in cities all over the world. Thank you, Mr. Millspaugh, for being here.
Thank you, Lisa. I'm glad to be here and glad to go on and tell the rest.
I understand that there were several Baltimore City mayors who had been elected to serve in office while the Inner Harbor was being transformed, one being Mayor William Donald Schaefer. Did the fact that there were several different administration changes do anything to change or affect the development of the projects? And did you personally ever feel overwhelmed by the magnitude of the project or just felt like pulling out of it altogether at any time?
No, I wouldn't say that. We didn't know when we started how big it would be, but it was always popular and always supported by people in the city, unless there was some small place that conflicted with one of theirs. People liked it. The things happened on schedule, and everything was on the way up. Jeff and I had this corporation which had a contract with the city, so we reported to the mayor, and there were at any time, and there were actually eight mayors altogether who were there during the time that the Inner Harbor was being developed. In 1972, William Donald Schaefer became mayor, and he was mayor number six. He had approved the master plan when he was president of city council, and he was became the Inner Harbor's biggest supporter and cheerleader. He was a leader of the carrying on of the Inner Harbor, and he was the one who popularized the phrase, do it now, and that's what he told us every day. He was very successful, and he brought with him Sandy Hillman, who started an office of promotion, and they started various events now in the Inner Harbor designed to draw people from all over the city and the entire area around the city. The first one was Sunny Sundays, they called them, in the park, which was a time when people could come and do whatever they wanted. Canoe races and free concerts, and every parade in Baltimore had to start or finish at the Inner Harbor. So things were really becoming a natural to the people of Baltimore. And by 1975, the promotion office had sponsored ethnic festivals, a different one on every weekend from May to September. That is, for 13 consecutive weeks, yeah. We had a different nationality every week.
I remember they were so, so wonderful and popular.
And by this time, it's becoming clear that the success of Charles Center and the Inner Harbor were changing the collective inferiority complex of Baltimore people into a feeling of pride, really, in their city. We felt that we needed a symbol of that, so we decided to have a Baltimore Clipper ship like the ones we had read about in our history books, because the Baltimore Clippers were famous not only the War of 1812, but they took on the British Navy and managed to make problems for them. We tried to find a real Baltimore Clipper, but by then there were none left. Mm-hmm. So we decided we'd have to build our own. The Pride of Baltimore was constructed on the shoreline of the Inner Harbor, where the shipyard on part of the park there, where the shipyard became an attraction for the public, with shipbuilders from South America using the tools of the same era as the original ships. It was launched in 1977. 10,000 people came on a cold February morning to watch the launching. Those people included James Rouse and his wife Patty, and they decided that Baltimore could create a tourist attraction after all. And that was important because they had just finished building the new city of Columbia, and we knew they could do whatever they thought they wanted to do.
Yes.
So the Pride, after that, became Baltimore's ambassador to the world, and it has sailed and still is sailing to many other countries where it holds open house and attracts future tourists. By 1976, just about that same time, the bicentennial of the United States gathered tall ships in New York from all over the world for the U.S. bicentennial celebration. Mm-hmm. We sent a team out to talk to their captains in Bermuda, and before they came to New York and after New York, eight of them came to Baltimore and tied up around the Inner Harbor. They held open house on board for the public for 10 days. That was really the big thing that changed the whole life of the Inner Harbor and therefore of Baltimore, because hundreds of thousands of people came to visit the tall ships from two or three states away. And we believed that we really might be able to become a tourist destination.
Now, can you talk about some of the details that went into actually building some of the other buildings in the Inner Harbor, like Harbor Place and the Aquarium and the Science Center?
We brought in consultants who knew about such things, and they advised us that Baltimore could have a tourist destination, but we had to add some major attractions. So we spent the next 5 years working on that to make it happen. The first one was the new Maryland Science Center, which had been planning for 10 years and had found a new location on the south end of the shoreline. And by 1979, we were building a Baltimore Convention Center, which was paid for with $35 million in state bonds. The state said if the development did not produce enough attractions to pay for the bonds, the city would have to make up the difference. Well, that was never a problem, and the convention center was immediately successful. Then the idea of an aquarium was put forth by Robert Embry, Jr., the Commissioner of Housing and Development for the city, and actually he was the client of our corporation. Our contract was with him, and the idea of an aquarium proved very popular as an idea, and hundreds of volunteers came forth to raise money and help in the operation of the aquarium. The city applied to Congress and had it named the National Aquarium in Baltimore, and it opened in 1981. It was projected to draw 200,000 people in a year. It drew more than 1 million and had a surplus in millions of dollars from Baltimore and other parts, and people from Baltimore and other parts of the country. Well, in the meantime, all this was going on at once, you realize, from the beginning of our job. We felt we needed a first-class hotel to create a tourist attraction, and we went to persuade the owners of the Hyatt Regency chain, which was just emerging into prominence around the world, and we wanted to persuade them to build on a lot facing the Inner Harbor Basin. It took 4 years, but we negotiated a public-private partnership with the Hyatt owners and obtained a $10 million grant from the federal government. Everyone had believed that Baltimore couldn't support an elite hotel like that. The Hyatt Regency opened in Baltimore in 1981, and it became the most successful hotel in the International Hyatt Regency chain.
Okay, now, what was it that made the Inner Harbor such a big tourist attraction? Was it the fact that it was the Science Center, the aquarium, and how much of that was because of the Harbor Place itself?
Well, Harbor Place was just the two pavilions on around the corner of Pratt and Light Streets, and it was the thing that created the real tourist destination. Because in 1976, Jim Rouse had opened Faneuil Hall, which was a festival marketplace on the waterfront in Boston. It was so successful that we called Mr. Rouse. I called him up and told him, as a Baltimorean, he needed to do that in the Inner Harbor. It was just what we needed. And he agreed, and he brought the Rouse Company to design and develop a festival marketplace called Harbor Place on the shoreline. It was a wonderful name. It was just the right name just for those two pavilions, but it came to symbolize the whole place. The opponents circulated a petition and raised 10,000 signatures to put a referendum on the city election ballot in 1978, which was opposing the idea of having buildings in the park. And that was the only real opposition we faced in 25 years. But we were able to develop a campaign in favor of Harbor Place, and we won the election by a margin of 3-2.
Oh, great, great.
Now, Harbor Place was a collection of a variety of shops and restaurants, and it was open to draw crowds at night and weekends and holidays. So there were outdoor restaurants that opened up to the outdoors with glass garage doors as the outside walls, and when they were pulled up, they had tables seating outside. So it was separated into two buildings. They were the last buildings, but they were separated into two buildings, so the world could see between them, could see the constellation, which was framed in the Inner Harbor as a sculptural presence with its full rigging and cannonade restored. Now, together, Harbor Place and the promenade brought everything into what the planners call a critical mass of attractions, meaning that the whole would draw more people than the greater than the sum of the parts, like a critical mass in the world of physics and chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
People watching became the favorite attraction because all kinds of people came from all over the world. The attendance was over 20 million from the first year. In 1981, when the aquarium opened, the New York Times reported it on page one, and they said the Inner Harbor was outdrawing Disney World, which only claimed 15 million. New York Magazine even put it on its cover, advertising Baltimore as a place to go for vacation. By that time, it was 1980, and in the next few years, all of the major attractions were expanded, and the Inner Harbor development area began to expand as an area in all four directions. It stimulated 5 new museums and 8 new hotels, and the former power plant was converted by the Cordish Company to the Hard Rock Cafe, the Barnes & Noble bookstore, and later on the Phillips Crab House.
Now, what did this all mean for the city of Baltimore in terms of total revenue, the creation of jobs, and things like that?
Well, we can sum it up and say it turned into a multi-billion dollar tourism industry where there was none before. It created 50,000 new jobs and brought in $60 million in new tax revenue.
Can you talk about how you became involved in replicating the Inner Harbor to waterfronts all over the world?
Yeah, the Inner Harbor's success was publicized all over in Sunday newspaper sections and airlines, magazines, and things like that, and the word spread. We began to be inundated by officials and developers from around the world who wanted to know how they could emulate Baltimore in their own hometowns. And the first turned out to be Sydney, Australia, where a developer had acquired the warehouses around the Darling Harbor, which was almost identical to the Baltimore Inner Harbor. This developer, who was Tom Hasten, went around the world to find out the best way to develop the Darling Harbor area into a tourist destination. The last place he came was Baltimore. And on his way home, he called me up and said Baltimore was the best and he would follow our lead in Sydney. He asked me and Jim Rouse to instruct the government out there on how to accomplish that. Well, we did that in 1984, and it became the most visited place in Australia. The Premier of the province of New South Wales told us later on that he would not have obtained the Olympics in 2000 if it were not for the Darling Harbour. Jim Rouse said by then we had done what we set out to do in the Inner Harbour, and I joined him in the Enterprise Development Company, which merged with British investors as the Merlin International Properties Limited to act as consultants in other cities around the world, and was listed on the London and Sydney stock exchanges.
Very impressive.
Well, we went to consult with officials in Barcelona, Spain, Osaka, Japan, Honolulu, and Belfast, Ireland, just to name some of the 35 cities where we became development consultants to show them how to replicate the Baltimore Inner Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, over this time, this was going on 25 years, of course, and the Baltimore projects over that time received more than 50 awards for excellence in design or development. The opinion of the American Institute of Architects said when they gave Baltimore an honor in 1981 that the Inner Harbor is one of the supreme achievements of large-scale urban design and development in U.S. history. The Urban Land Institute said that Baltimore became the model for cities all around the world, and the momentum created by the Charles Center and Inner Harbor has expanded into the development of such huge places as Harbor East, Harbor Point, and, of course, the Port Covington of today.
Now, Mr. Millspaugh, I understand you're working on a book to talk about all of this wonderful history of Baltimore. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it's an account of that section of Baltimore history, which has never really been documented in such a form. And, it was a pivotal milestone in Baltimore history, and it etched its image in making the Baltimore Inner Harbor so famous around the world. The book will be published as soon as I can finish making the arrangements. And in the meantime, my archives are available to the public at the Sheraton Library of Johns Hopkins University. There's also a website and a 60-minute DVD called Global Harbors, which was produced by Maryland Public Television and Ivy Productions.
Well, this has been quite a remarkable story in the history of Baltimore. And Mr. Martin Millspaugh, we thank you so much for being here and for sharing this great history lesson with us.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed sharing it, and obviously I enjoy talking about it.
This has been A Valuable Perspective, brought to you by Roland Park Place. Please be sure to check out next month's episode as we continue to bring stories, ideas, and valuable lessons from the residents of Roland Park Place. And for more information about Roland Park Place, please visit our website at rolandparkplace.org. I'm Lisa Haynes.